Award, and she was shortlisted for the Nebula, nominated for a Locus, won an Ignite Award, a Bram Stoker Award, and then did win a Nebula for Ling Huynh, sorry, I said it wrong, and I'll probably screw that up in the interview too, I can't remember, the interview's already done, but anyway, shortlisted for a couple of other awards, and shortlisted for a Hugo. It's pretty heavy duty, man. And I don't think she's all that old. I didn't ask her age. It didn't really matter. But anyway, we got to do an event together during Supercrawl here in Hamilton at the author's tent. It was great to get to know her and saw her read at Lit Live here in Hamilton. If you've been listening to the show the last couple of months, those events were all talked about on the show here. So finally got to have her on the show here with me, and we'll talk to her in just a minute or so. In the meantime, I want to say, if you want to check out back episodes of the show, this is episode 413, which is breaking my brain a little bit. That's about 8 years of shows, and we're going to be going on at least to 500. That's the plan. Possibly taking it down from weekly to bi-weekly, or is it semi-weekly? I don't know. Not sure, though. But for now, no changes, at least until 2025. And we've got lots of great shows coming up. We're going to have Gary Barwin on the show. Kit Dobson's going to be on the show. Nick Cutter's going to be on the show, I'm pretty sure. Supposed to talk to him on the 21st. All kinds of great things happening. So make sure you stay tuned. And as always, read the books, buy the book, support the authors, support your local writing scene, if there is one. And there is one. You maybe just don't know it yet. I'm going to shut up. We're going to go talk to I. Listening to Get Lit, and I am on the phone with someone. Hey, we were just hanging out like 2 days ago. I Jong is here to talk about a couple of things, more than one book. We're gonna kind of talk about everything if we can. Hi, I.
Hello. Thanks for having me today.
Happy to have you. You were just in Hamilton doing a Lit Live reading. How'd that go?
Nerve-wracking, as always, because of my public speaking anxiety, but we survived.
You know, it's funny, I did not know that about you, and then Andrew said that he was there. I think your first reading was at his launch, is that true?
So he was at my launch first, and then okay. I was at his launch, so it
right.
was like a, yeah.
Okay, were you well aware that the public speaking thing would be a part of getting into this world, or was that sort of a like, oh geez, I never thought of that?
Like, it was at the back of my mind, but I tried not to think about it.
Well, you can't tell. I mean, you do a great job, so don't worry too much. I just can only imagine that the anxiety leading up to it is not fun.
No, I like used to do tutoring actually, and some teaching, and each time before a class, I would just have like a mental breakdown, but then during the class, it would be okay, and after the class, I would just have to like collapse on the couch.
That sounds exhausting.
It was, that's why I don't tutor anymore.
So I whenever someone's on the show for the first time, I ask them the same question, and that was, what in the world led you to want to become a writer?
I feel like I've always liked writing. Like, I've always read books growing up. Like, I would beg my mom to get the Scholastic's book orders when I was in elementary school and things like that. And then I always wanted to write my own book, but I never thought it was, like, a viable career type of thing until way later. Mm-hmm. Oh, my cat's on the table. So sorry.
It's okay.
And I feel like it was during the pandemic when I really had time to like sit down and think about what I wanted to do with my time that I was like, actually, I really want to dedicate my life to writing.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you have had a great amount of success, and it came all within like what, the last, since the pandemic, like in the last 4 years?
Yes.
That's wild. That's wild. You have been nominated for and won a bunch of different awards. How was that? I mean, did you, to have some acknowledgement of your work so early in a career, have you just kind of been continually shocked and blown away by this?
Yes. I feel like it's been a wild time, because when I began to write, that was like not... I mean, obviously, I would have wanted to win awards, but that was not the ultimate goal. So I very much wrote with the mindset that, oh, I just want someone to connect and read my work. So after everything that's happened in the past few years, I'm just like, what is going on?
Well, what was the first, what was your entry into publishing? What was the first thing that you got out there?
So I believe it was a short story in late 2020. And I got it published in Maudlin House. That was like my very first publication, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was my entry. But because of my background in English Lit, I was very much in like the realist fiction world instead of SFF. Mm-hmm. But I realized I like to write SFF a lot more. And gradually, somehow, I just like moved into writing more SFF and speculative fiction.
And that's where, of course, people started to really take notice. So that's kind of fascinating. It's cool, though. I mean, did you do a lot of writing for yourself back when you were studying Lit?
No, actually. I like had no time. All of my time was dedicated to just reading and analyzing, because I'm a very slow reader when I'm trying to analyze text.
Okay.
So it would be like 10 to 30 pages in an hour, and it'll take me forever to read.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's tough, and you don't end up with any time to do your own thing on the end of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Where did you
mind's like already so tired.
Exactly. Where'd you go to school for that?
Yeah, UFT.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So you get out there, you shift over to sci-fi fantasy and speculative fiction, and it's still short stories mostly, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So eventually, and those have done really well, and they're great, and even in your print edition here of Lingun, there's a... I say that improperly. I do apologize. There's a bunch of short stories at the end of that as well. Are these some of the ones that were previously published?
So one of them, Yongshi, was previously published in the Dark magazine,
right.
And the other one, Teeter Totter, was not.
Okay.
I actually got a bunch of personal and final round rejections from some of the big magazines for it, and then I was like, I don't know what else I can do with this story. And then Rob wanted to make Linghun like a bit bulkier, because novellas are usually quite slim, and he was asking me if I had any short stories, either reprinted or original, that I wanted to include with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought about this one, because I was like, I just need it to be out there.
Okay, and that's fair enough, right? These are all your babies. You want them all to see the light of day eventually.
Yes.
So now, what was the first of your short stories then that you think told you that this was going to be a viable career, that you got attention for, or maybe not even that. Maybe you just read it back to yourself and thought, yeah, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to do this.
I feel like there isn't one specific short story that told me this was going to be a viable career, but there was one short story that told me that perhaps I am not terrible at this. and that story was Give Me English, because I remember when I wrote that story, I had been brewing on it for like a year in my mind. But when I finally wrote it, it was in the span of an afternoon. And for some reason in my head, I was just like, this is the one. This is the one that is going to get attention. And somehow it did become the one that got attention. I had sent it to the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. And Cherie was editing at the time. Well, she's still editing now. And she had given me an R&R for it. And the story grew from about 2,500 words to like 4,800, I believe.
Right.
Which was wild. And that one was nominated for like the very first award I was ever nominated for, which was the Nebulas.
Which is a pretty good award to start with, right? Like, wow.
Yeah, it was wild. And I think because my parents, like my dad especially, really base like success on things like award and income, that was the first time he was like, oh, maybe you can't do this thing.
So you come now to your story's expanded. You talked about one story going from like 2,500 to 5,000 words, and now, of course, the novellas, right? So the two that I have recently read, and you jokingly said you talked about Lin Quan enough. You've been talking about it a lot. But let's talk about it just a little tiny bit more, shall we? How did this story come to be? What was the genesis? Because it's about a couple of different things at once, really. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, like, what came first and what inspired you to tell this tale and where the idea came from?
So I was thinking a lot about ghosts and haunted houses. And one thing I was thinking about is the way that ghosts often haunt us. And I wanted to kind of subvert that trope and make it like the living that's haunting the dead. And it actually came about in this anthology called that was accepting submissions called Ghost Lore. Mm-hmm. It was edited by Lindsay Curl at the time. And I decided to write a flash piece for it. And it was about 800 words. And a version of that scene is actually in Lin Quan.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. So it began as a flash piece. And I had an idea to expand it into a longer piece, but I never did it until Rob from Dark Matter reached out and he was like, oh, do you do any long form? And at that time I didn't, but I was like, I don't, but I can write one if you would like. And so he was like, okay, sure. Like, give me a pitch, sample chapters, and we'll see, like, we'll go from there. So that's basically how Lin Quan came to be.
But it's such a fun, in a creepy way, a fun idea and a fascinating idea, and definitely unlike anything I'd ever heard before. But it's clearly about people not being able to get through their grief, to let it go, and the desire to cling to it, and how it's just never satisfying. It doesn't seem to matter to these people that they, you know, they see their child again, if let's say in the example of your main character's family, but it doesn't seem to make anybody happier.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just about that. It's also kind of about countries, right? And about our places of birth and our homelands and stuff like that, mm-hmm. too. Explain how those two went together in your head.
So, originally, the character of Mrs., who really, like, explores immigration, placelessness, and, like, migrating from a different country to one that's foreign, did not exist in her current form.
Right.
Yeah, so I didn't intend at first to include her as a perspective, because I wanted the book to really focus on, like, the grief of loved ones and things like that. But then I was thinking about the fact that immigration is almost like grieving a past home, a past life, right? When you move to one place to another, you will always be thinking about the past and where you came from. And, like, traces of your homeland will appear in, like, your new home. So that's kind of, like, my approach to it.
Well, I mean, this is something, obviously, that's had a big effect on you and your family.
Mm-hmm.
Was that something that you went to your own families and your personal experiences in that?
Yeah, so I came to Canada when I was about 4.
Right.
But I still remember that moment very clearly, even though my parents were like, how do you remember such things in detail? I'm like, well, it's traumatic for a 4-year-old to have to fly across the country.
Totally.
Yeah, but they were like, that's wild how I remember that. But, I did not realize that I essentially based the neighborhood home on where I used to live in Scarborough until after I'd written it. And I was looking back at it, and I was like, oh, this is essentially, like, my landscape growing up, because my, like, the neighborhood I lived in was filled with new immigrants who, like, came and left and were grieving like their past life or like trying to settle in into their new life. Mm-hmm. And then in this neighborhood, it's kind of paralleled, but with loved ones instead.
Exactly.
And yeah. people coming and going and getting stuck in this almost like liminal space and trying to leave, but don't know how to.
It's interesting too, because this is a ghost story, but I don't feel like it's not a horror story. You know, what was your main, like when you were talking about the ghosts themselves, you didn't want them to be scary, but what was it, what were you drawing on to sort of, they're barely characters, right? So to create mm-hmm. these characters isn't quite right, but what were your inspirations for the way the ghosts are and how they behave?
So I was kind of like using them almost as a metaphor of mm-hmm. fading memories. Like whenever you talk about grief and you talk about like losing people, everyone's always like, oh, like I'm very afraid that one day I won't remember them anymore,
right,
you know,
right.
Or like over time their features are fading and like they kind of feel guilty about forgetting people who have moved on, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of my idea when I was writing descriptions about these ghosts and like their presentation kind of as like a memory that is stalled in our minds trying to move on themselves perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
in for these characters, they don't want to let these memories go. They want to hold on to it for as long as they can, as clearly as they can. So that's why for some characters, the ghosts are very clear because they still remember them very vividly versus
yeah.
other characters who might not have as like a strong of a memory of the dead. They don't see them as clearly.
Exactly. It's personalized and it's a fascinating part of the story. And of course, another fun / horrifying thing, actually the most horrifying thing in the book has nothing to do with ghosts and everything to do with the fact that here is this supernatural phenomenon, and of course there's some kind of corporation making money off it and making people behave in the most horrible ways possible. That was the horrifying part of the story.
Yes.
Was that something you was always a part of it, or did that come later, that scene or that idea?
So it's funny because originally, I had intended on a very muted and stoic version of that scene
mm-hmm.
where people are literally just like deadpan, sitting in silence, raising paddles until my editor asked me, what if we make it more dramatic, make it very characterized?
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought about it and I was like, that would make sense because in this neighborhood a lot of people are doing things that essentially don't make sense,
right?
And going to like drastic lengths just to see their dead loved ones, and it would make sense that they might go to such like absurd extents to try to stay in this neighborhood and try to see their dead loved ones.
Yeah, and the result is like not the best of human nature.
No.
No.
So I remember when I was writing it, it just got like wilder and wilder. And I was like, should I tone it down? But then I was like, no, because then I feel like it made sense in the context of the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a nice contrast to a lot of the tone in the book as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's leave this book behind. Let's not not try to let it haunt us any longer in this interview. I want to talk about the first book. I won't get into it, but there was a misunderstanding when we did our event together and I read the other book. But that's actually the most recent one, is I Am I. It's a very, very, very different kind of book. Why don't you just briefly tell our listeners what that one's about?
So it is essentially about a character named I, who is living in like a late capitalist society overrun by AI and corporations. And she is essentially posing as AI to try to compete with the AI dominated society.
Now, obviously, as AI must be something that you thought about because, of course, before you even wrote this book, because you are a writer and the large language models are, you know, people are all like, oh, it's going to make writing really easy and they're going to make movies and music and all that nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
So how much of this was on your mind before you even chose to write this story.
So what is hilarious is I wrote this in, let's see when it came out. So November 2022.
Oh, wow.
I had been thinking about this book for about a year and a half prior to that.
Okay.
It was like an idea brewing in my mind, but like the seed of the idea very much focused not so much on AI, but just like toxic work culture in general, mm-hmm. and the labor market of how like corporations in particular are looking for workers who can work longer, harder, and get paid less than everyone else, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We can see with like the recent layoffs and positions being lost. But yeah, so that was what I thought about initially when I was writing this book. But then eventually it became a fear of like automation and what mm-hmm. jobs that would take away as the idea developed. And I remember when I finally wrote it, that was like just before ChatGPT was getting a lot of hype, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember I was like, oh, if I don't get this book now, people are going to be like, this is just the present. This is not far future anymore. But then at the time I was thinking about this idea, it felt very much far future, right? Or at least like far future, but with very present sentiments of like toxic work culture and burnout.
Yeah, and it's the main character is such a great, you've drawn a character that really, really reflects these themes. I feel like, of course, I is a cyborg and is almost always out of power, which I think is a great metaphor for a whole bunch of things. How did you get into this character's mind, given that this character is very largely machine?
So this character was essentially based on a time when I was working as a ghostwriter. This was after I tutored. So I gave up tutoring and I got into ghostwriting because I was like, oh, I want to do writing. But I didn't know how to really like get into fiction type of thing. So I did ghostwriting first.
Right.
But like in ghostwriting, you essentially get paid, or at least for my job, by the page. So it's like the quicker you write, the more you get paid. The slower you write, the less you get paid, right? So it very much felt like I was some kind of factory conveyor belt when I was working as a ghostwriter, just like churning out content as quickly as I can
That's great. I'm keeping that in. I love that.
As quickly as I can to make as much money as I can. And so this character is basically based on me back then when I was essentially not eating well, not like barely sleeping. Sometimes I'd be up like 48 to 60 hours at a time just trying to like meet deadlines or try to take on more work than I really should.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just constantly on the verge of burnout because I'll try to take like 15-minute naps every 24 hours or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me feel very like mechanical and on the verge of just like collapsing type
right.
of thing.
Yeah,
so this character is very meta in that way.
It's meta in several ways. I mean, it's your name, and it's a fascinating thing to look at. It's such a great story. I really enjoy the other thing that you did that I'm sure everyone consents it. I don't know if it gets talked about as much, is the way you drew community, the way you talk about I's community, where they live, where mm-hmm. the place that they work. It just feels very much in opposition to the city.
Mm-hmm.
And it also feels, you know, despite so many people being partially robotic, it feels so human and lived in.
Mm-hmm.
How much was the geography that you had created in your mind an important part of that story?
So I feel like whenever I'm writing books, like unconsciously bits and pieces of like my lived experiences and past lives creep into it. And I think the honeycomb in IMI, the community under mm-hmm. the bridge, the architecture was actually inspired by a project that my spouse was working on because he's an architect.
Mm-hmm.
And he was working on this project where it's like accessible homes in downtown Toronto because there's so much room under the bridge. He was thinking, oh, maybe they can build kind of like homeless shelters that are like under the bridge, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so people can use. And the community itself was very much based on like my grandma's side of the family. When we used to live in China, she lived right. in a village. It was like six villages that are interconnected in a way. It doesn't exist anymore. It's like a whole bunch of condos now.
Mm-hmm.
But in those villages, everyone's homes were interconnected. It was very easy for you to just like open a window and absolutely see someone changing in their bedroom type of thing. So there was like no privacy, and people would just like barge into your home type of thing and be like, hey. And I was like, everyone's like up in each other's business. And it kind of like seeped into that when I was building this honeycomb community, where like everyone's doing their own thing, but at the same time they really care about each other even though they're doing their own thing, and they'll just kind of like check in on you randomly even if you're not super close, or if you don't think you are super close, but in their mind maybe you are.
Yeah, that's the feeling. It really has that feeling, which I thought was just like so lovely. And we can't discuss it, but the ending, spoiler free zone, but I thought the ending was absolutely perfect, but I was worried for a little while. I was like, no. Oh, okay, good.
You know, it's really funny because a lot of people say that I'm known for like doomed but hopeful endings. I don't know why that is, but like I Am I was actually supposed to have quite a bleak ending mm-hmm. to begin with. But then I thought, you know what? Things are already super bleak. Let's make this more hopeful.
Because when you're reading a story like that, right, like I feel like you already can see the bleak ending in front of you. It's not like you're yeah. blind to that possibility. So mm-hmm. when you do read something that has a bit more hope to it, it's like reassuring and it feels good. But it didn't erase the bleak ending. You still yeah. saw it, you know, mm-hmm. in the future. But it just, we took another timeline, I guess. somehow we're almost out of time, so I want to ask a question that I'm curious about, but it's not an important question. But the question is, you have written short stories, you've lengthened that up to novella. Are you interested in writing something novel length? Is that something we'll see from you?
So I don't know if I'm supposed to talk about it yet, but I've written it.
Okay,
there
cool.
is something coming. I will just leave it at that.
And you know what? That's good enough. I was just curious anyway. We have been talking to Ai Zhang, and the books, there's a couple of them. The most recent book we were talking about is I Am I. And it's been wonderful getting to meet you a couple times in the last month, and always great to talk to you. Thanks for taking the time to be on the show.
Thank you so much for having me again and for these wonderful questions. I had a great time.
Thank you. Thanks to Ai for being my guest today. Thanks to Afternoons in Stereo for the music, to CFMU for the studios, and to you for listening in. My name's Jamie. You can reach me at getlitshow@gmail.com.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back to CinemaScope. I am your host, Scarlett Sapir, right here on 93.3 CFMU-FM. Now, the last movie that I watched is The Apprentice, the new Donald Trump biopic. And I mean, yes, on paper, it is a Trump biopic all about, you know, his rise to fame, success, money, all in the 70s, and then ending off when he starts writing his book, The Art of the Deal. But really, the film is a catalyst to a more open discussion about these just terrible parts in the underbelly of American capitalism, in the underbelly of how systems put in place to, you know, stop people from doing terrible things are completely worked around without any regard. And just the premise that terrible people create more terrible people. The film is far from sympathetic to Trump, but I will say that it shows us, you know, how he developed all of these just horrible, horrible traits that we are seeing, you know, today in American politics, which is really, really scary. There's a lot of really fantastic cinematography in this movie. It's all done in a very, like, old-school 70s style. If you've seen, like, Don't Look Now or Clute, you'll definitely see some similar shots from that era. I'll also say the soundtrack really stood out to me. It's all just, like, this bumpin' beat synth, all this awesome music. And all of these things are made to, you know, make the film, A, feel like a period piece even, where all of these ideals that he's saying are super dated and stuck in that time, and then we just